Hi, Aaron.
Hey, Dina, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good.
Good. Hope everybody's doing well over by you.
yes,
As well as can
everyone's
be.
doing it. Yeah, no, really, yes, absolutely.
Good.
Bizarre, but not
I know. Well,
yeah.
thank you for doing this.
Oh, it's a
Basically,
pleasure.
I am recording this, but I will trim out anything that we're saying right now in the final recording. So if you need to ask me any questions or anything, feel free and I'll make sure that it doesn't appear in the final version of the presentation. For the panelists that we've had so far, we've been going about 35 minutes with you doing your presentation, and then we'll break out into Q&A, unless you like have strong opinions about, taking Q&A throughout the course of the session.
I don't know. So just to be clear, so I've not done what are these called?
A
Not
Zoom
Zoom. No, not Zoom meetings, but
webinar.
Zoom webinars. So I can't see anyone, is that right?
You cannot see anybody. I've disabled everybody's cameras. If people want to ask questions, they can either do so in the chat function or in the Q&A function at the bottom, or there's actually a way for people to virtually raise their hand and I can unmute their microphone and let them ask you a question like audibly.
Got it. I don't have any strong opinions, so I am happy to maybe encourage people to write in questions throughout on
Okay.
chat or Q&A, and then
Sure.
afterwards at the end people can also talk if they have something to say. But
Fantastic.
I
Are
really
you
don't have
going to
any
be
strong
sharing any
opinions.
slides or anything?
Many slides.
Great.
Yeah, no, my problem is this morning I was like, okay, I'm going to do this and this and this, and I put it together. I was like, that's going to be like 2.5 hours. And he's, I was like, I'm sure people have nothing to do. Like, why can't we just go? But I thought, it might be a good idea to cut it. So I tried to trim it down. So we're
Well,
going
we
to do some
appreciate
things
that.
quickly.
Great. And you know how to share screens and everything at the bottom?
Yes, I
Great.
assume like everyone on the faculty is now experts on Zoom. It's such a
Probably.
pleasure.
We'll get rid of all of our real
Yeah.
estate in Manhattan and we'll switch to Zoom from now on.
Oh, it's not a joke. I don't know. I have no idea what we'll be doing, but I'm sure that there are lots of institutions like thinking, wait a second,
Probably after this, yeah.
this is very expensive, and can we do this? How much of this can we do?
We'll see.
Yeah. My dad, who I see is actually on, although I assume he can't hear us yet. Is that right?
No, they actually can, so say
Oh,
hi.
okay. Hi, Dad. How are you? My dad teaches in Touro in Yerushalayim,
Oh.
and they have similar considerations, or at least
Yeah.
I'm sure they will.
For sure. I'm actually, with your permission, going to share this to Facebook so that it's streaming on the YU alumni Facebook page. So we'll get some more upticks that way too.
Okay, cool. How many people do you expect on this? Just
There's
thinking
really
about
no
the
way to say,
dynamic.
like, we've had such a range. We've had 20 depending on the session, or we've had 80 depending on the session.
Oh,
And
wow.
then, but with putting it up on Facebook, I'm also seeing like well over 100 like
Wow.
logins to view that. So it ranges, and people, if they aren't watching live, they'll watch it back on Facebook later on once I share it. So
This is recorded on Facebook.
it's record, yeah, once I put it up on Facebook and share it on Facebook, it saves on our page.
And you are you also recording it on Zoom? I assume
Yes.
you are. Yes, you
Yep.
said you are.
Recording it
And
on
what are you
Zoom
doing
as
with
well.
those things?
So we are posting the recorded sessions once I've trimmed up the beginning where we're just chattering away. We're posting it on the page where I have the full schedule of classes listed,
Oh, smart.
and also sending out the recording to everybody who is tuned in to watch it.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
This is great. I'm
So
very happy about it.
yeah, no, we're happy too. I'm gonna mute my phone, my microphone for right now while I get this up on Facebook and start going. And then at like 12:30, if you need anything, just holler. I'm here. But then at like 12:30-ish, I'll give you the cue and you can start whenever you're ready.
Sounds good.
All right,
I
thank you.
will.
I'm here if you need me.
Okay, thanks.
Dr. Kohler, whenever you're ready to get started, feel free.
All right. Let's, okay, welcome. So hi, everyone. This is Aaron Kohler. I teach at Yeshiva University and a number of the schools, including the Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies. And it's a real pleasure to connect with you this way during these strange, slightly absurd, and scary times. We're going to be studying, looking at a topic that I've been working on teaching for a number of years, that I think actually is relevant in a lot of ways to our lifetimes, relevant to our culture. Says something about the connectedness of the world even a long time ago, which of course we're now acutely aware of, as well as gets at the heart of something that we use all the time, and that's the alphabet. So I'm going to start sharing this screen, and we're going to hopefully run through a number of different issues related to the origins of the alphabet. The most important thing, if there's one thing that I want you to walk away from today with sort of clear knowledge of, is that the alphabet was invented only once. So any language, any writing system that uses an alphabet, that's all the result of one particular invention about 4,000 years ago. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. And that one invention has multiplied and ramified and spiraled throughout world history since then. We'll talk about just how great an invention it was or was not, but that's the most important thing to say. So when you talk about the origins of the alphabet or alphabet, and if you say, you know, hey, I heard a class about the origins of the alphabet, and someone says, well, which alphabet? Do you mean the Hebrew alphabet? Do you mean the Arabic alphabet? Do you mean the English alphabet? You say, well, that's the whole point. It was invented only once. All right, so we're going to try to run through a couple of preliminary issues before we actually get to the alphabet. And this is to make sure that it's clear what we're talking about when we talk about an alphabet. So the first thing is that we're not talking about language. So language is really, really old. We don't know exactly how old, but probably in the hundreds of thousands of years. It's likely that there never were Homo sapiens who didn't have the capability of speaking in some sort of language. So that's not what we're talking about. That goes way back beyond the history that we're dealing with. The next thing that sort of emerges in human history are things like art. And this is also really, really old. So we have artifacts. I'm just going to give you two for fun. The Lion Man, the Löwenmensch from Hohenstein-Stadel in Germany, which is almost 40,000 years old. And of course, the Lascaux Caves, which are slightly newer, you know, a little bit less than 30,000 years old. But humans have been creating art for tens of thousands of years. And there is certainly a connection between art and writing, but they are obviously not the same thing. And we're going to see in a few minutes how to define that a little bit better. In other words, how we can be precise about saying that these pictures you see in front of you from the Lascaux Caves are not in fact writing, even though they might be symbolic in some way.
Aaron, I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't think your screen is shared. I'm not seeing anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. Give me one second. Let me... check the settings there. Is that better now?
Yep, you're good.
Okay, fantastic. Fantastic. Okay, so let me go back. So this is the Lion Man, and these are the Lascaux Caves, which are probably familiar to many of you. Okay, now writing itself emerged only probably about 5,000 years ago, a little bit more. And we have some hypotheses, but no real good data on how writing actually started. I'm going to share one hypothesis, which is probably not exactly right, but is really suggestive to think about how writing started. We have archaeologically for the last 8,000 years, we have little things that you see in front of you on the screen that archaeologists call tokens. And these were sort of bookkeeping devices. And to think about how they might work, you can think about, let's say, the story of Lavan and Yaakov or Moshe and his father-in-law. In other words, a hired shepherd who's hired to take care of the sheep during the grazing season. And of course, is responsible for coming back at the end of the grazing season and bringing the sheep back to the owner. And if Lavan says to Yaakov at the end of the grazing season, okay, great, welcome back. You know, I'd like to see my 500 sheep that you started with. The bureaucratic question is how do we know that there were actually 500 sheep? What if Yaakov says 500 sheep? What do you mean? There were only 300 sheep. And he presents the 300 sheep, and Lavan says, no, I know that there were 500 sheep, and how can we ever resolve such a question? So about 8,000 years ago, in Mesopotamia, people came up with this system of tokens, and you see that there's cones and spheres and discs, and they represent various measures. So these were actually used for grain, probably, but there were similar systems for animals. And you would have these tokens, and you would put them aside. You'd say, well, I'm going to count them out. You know, here's a bunch of 20 tokens. So that's the 20s, that's, you know, the 400 sheep and then another 10, sort of like Monopoly money. And then what do you do with these tokens? So they would put them into these clay envelopes, they're called envelopes by archaeologists, but they're basically clay balls and sealed up and then put into some sort of agreed upon area. So we have a system now for bookkeeping, a system that that when you come back and you say there were only 250 sheep or 300 sheep, and I say, no, there were 500 sheep. We can actually go open this little clay envelope and see how many tokens had been put inside. And that will be a way of verifying how many sheep had actually been sent out at the beginning of the season. And that system was in place for a few thousand years, actually, probably 3,000-4,000 years, until someone had the bright idea to do what you see in the picture in front of you, which was to mark on the outside of the envelope what was inside the envelope. In other words, instead of having to open that envelope to find out how many tokens there were, you could keep those tokens in the envelope, but you could also write on the outside, there's 14 cones, 2 spheres, and a disc. In other words, there's 320 sheep or whatever they may be. And we can verify that by opening it, but it's also marked on the outside so that it's known without opening it. And that could be useful for all sorts of bureaucratic and economic reasons that you could probably think about as well. After another couple of thousand years, someone had a really bright idea and said, essentially, well, wait a second, if we're marking it on the outside of this envelope, what do we need the tokens on the inside of the envelope at all for? We actually have a system for writing down how many sheep have just gone out with the shepherd. And so that's essentially the beginning of the first writing systems, which are pictographs. They might say things like 33, in this case, jars of oil, or 8 donkeys, or something of the sort. They really can't say any more than that. But this happens about 3,300 BCE. So about 5,300 years ago in southern Iraq, in Mesopotamia. And we started to get some basic bookkeeping on clay tablets. And in a sense, this is the beginning of writing. It's a little bit complicated because what we have is not really writing proper. You can now write 1 donkey or 8 donkey. But of course, there's something that is notable about writing 1 donkey or 8 donkey. 8 donkey is bad English. In English, we would have to say 8 donkeys. In other words, having some sort of plural marker on the end of that word. And that's true in Sumerian and in pretty much every language. There's some sort of plural marker on the word, but the writing that was invented 5,300 years ago can't write that. And there's no way to write 8 donkeys. And more importantly, there's no reason to write 8 donkeys. If you just write 8 donkey, obviously it's plural. Obviously there's more than one of those little donkey things. And there's really no reason to mark that when I pronounce that, when I read it out in my language, I would actually end that word with a plural marker, an S in English or a mesh in Sumerian, but it's just irrelevant. All I'm writing is 8 donkey, 3 sheep, 2 goat, and we'll leave it at that. So there's just no reason for more information in the writing. And of course, even more importantly, when you start to think about it, this as writing, you can't say anything about what those donkeys are doing. So there's no way of indicating in these tablets, these kind of tablets, there's no way of saying whether these donkeys are walking across a green meadow, whether they actually are not real but showed up in a dream that I had last night. In other words, complicated sentences that involve tenses, verbs, those things just can't be written in these early systems. So in a real sense, this is not full writing, and we have to wait a little bit longer to get to full writing. To get to full writing, we want something that's a way of essentially writing down, or that's putting down into graphic notation, anything I can say. So you could take this whole, the whole transcript of our time here together this afternoon, this evening, and a real writing system should be able to take everything that I'm saying here and everything that you're all writing in the chat and the Q&A, which I hope you're writing in, and putting that into our writing system. And of course, we can do that in any writing system that we know of. So it could be in English, or it could be in Hebrew, it could be in Arabic, it could be in Russian, it could be in Chinese. Those things are all real writing systems, with the key point being that using any of those writing systems, we can actually transcribe any sentence that I can think of. But something like this, a system that essentially consists of, you know, 12 jar oil, 8 donkey, this is a beginning of writing, but it's really not a full writing system. So we're going to, I'll just sort of note that some of these ways of conveying ideas still function in our writing systems as well, or in our culture as well, sometimes in within our writing system. So of course, you know, a sign like this, this colorful circle thing with the lines through it, if I asked you what it means, so I don't know where all of you are and you know what background all of you have, but I'm going to assume that most of you would say it means peace, which is of course true, but that's not even enough, because we have to say what kind of peace this is. This is not the peace that means like they signed the Treaty of Versailles, now Europe is at peace. That's certainly not this kind of peace. This is a very particular kind of, you know, anti-war, free love, end of all conflict kind of peace, specifically in the American 60s. So it conveys an idea, but the point is that it doesn't convey an idea that's actually equivalent to a particular word in the language. It conveys an idea. And those things certainly still happen in our culture. The sign on the right with the male and female, of course, conveys something particular as well, if you see that in the airport. And there's a reason that we use things like this. As the reason, let's take that airport sign. The reason that that's such a useful sign to have is specifically that it's not in a particular language. You can read it in your language. I can read it in my language. We all know what it means. And that's really the basic idea of a logogram. So if I go back for a second to this, you actually have no idea what language this is in. You just know what the idea is that's being conveyed by these pictures. So sometimes that's really useful. In an airport, where you have people passing through who are speaking any of the world's 6,000 languages, you don't want to have to write a sign in the 100 most common languages or so. You want to be able to have a sign that conveys an idea in whatever language. You'll process that in whatever language you happen to speak. Now, we have the same thing in our writing systems with things like numerals. So if I take these numerals, how you read those numerals will depend on which of those sentences your eyes happen to gravitate towards. And you'll actually pronounce them differently, even though the signs are exactly the same. So numerals actually play an interesting role, sort of in between symbols and real writing. I'll just mention that there are some things that are relatively new that are sort of returned to logograms. Not all emojis are really logograms. A lot of emojis simply are sort of metalinguistic, and they tell you how to read a sentence. So a smiley face or a wink, you wouldn't read that out loud. But if you have folded hands, which is a, you know, a way of saying thank you, you can actually read that as thank you. And the, you know, the point is that that's sort of functionally equivalent to a logogram. It's language independent, and it conveys an idea of gratitude without having to actually decide what language I'm speaking. But all of this is in the beginnings of language, of writing, I'm sorry. And the key is that in pictographs and in logograms, writing or these symbols map onto the level of ideas. The huge conceptual leap that enables actual writing is to map onto the level of sounds. That's when you have a full writing system. Full writing systems can actually transcribe any sound that I can make. So you'll hear the difference between donkey and donkeys, because my writing system can actually convey that final zzz. And that's really important. Okay, so I'm gonna now assume that we have writing in the world, and writing, you know, exists from about 5,000 years ago, a little bit more. It starts for the first time in Mesopotamia, and then pretty quickly, like within a century or so, which I guess, you know, may or may not sound like quick to you, but for ancient historians, a century is, you know, like the blink of an eyelash. So within a century or so, we find writing in Egypt as well. And that's, of course, hieroglyphs. The earliest hieroglyphs are about 3200 BCE, as far as we know now. And it's likely, although sort of not provable, that the Egyptians got the idea of writing from the Mesopotamians, even though they made up their own system for actually how to do it. But about 1500 years later, we start to find an alphabet. So that's sort of the end of what we're about to talk about. And here's a story that we actually have. An archaeologist named Sir William Flinders Petrie, who you can tell from the way he looks and the way he's dressed, was a proper British gentleman, was a prominent archaeologist by the beginning of the 20th century. He had dug in primarily Egypt, but also in Palestine and a couple other places around the region. And in the early 1900s, in 1903, he was digging in Sinai at a site called Sirabit al-Khadim, which is down in southern Sinai, a pretty isolated site, famous because it has turquoise mines there. No longer functional. They haven't been functional in thousands of years, but the ancient Egyptians mined turquoise in this site of Sirabit al-Khadim. And you have on the left side of the screen an excerpt from his publication where he talks about what he found there. And you see that even though he wrote the book, he writes, "On looking over the broken rocks about that mine, my wife noticed a fragment with some signs upon it, which could not be recognized. I searched farther, and on turning over the falling block, I found more signs. I then brought over some men." Now, Petrie was an excellent Egyptologist. He could read Egyptian without a problem. So we're going to skip a few lines. And he says, "But none of the inscriptions were intelligible as Egyptian of any hieratic or debased type." So he reads Egyptian, no problem, but he's looking at these things. He's like, "I don't know what they are. They're not Egyptian. It's not hieroglyphs, not hieratic, which is sort of cursive hieroglyphs, cursive Egyptian. There's no way to make these make sense as Egyptian. So not a word of regular Egyptian could be read. Some of the signs looked like hieroglyphs to him, but they just weren't intelligible." So as a really good researcher, he put them out there. He published drawings of them, published photographs of some of the better preserved ones, and said, "You know, I don't know what these are, but they're out here for anyone to work on." So this is one of them that he found. This is a little sphinx, which has the official number Sinai 346. And you see that it's covered with all these scribbles and signs, but Petrie couldn't make sense of them. About a decade later, 1916, Sir Alan Gardner, who is a really interesting person who actually has some connection to the Jewish community, but in a bizarre way that I won't go into now, figured out what they were essentially. He looked at them and he puzzled over them, and he published an article saying, like, I got it. This is actually the earliest alphabet. Now, one of the text that he used to sort of break this open was this little sphinx. I'm sorry, I call that other one a sphinx. This little sphinx that you see has on the left side here has some of these signs. They've been chalked in so that they're more easily read. That chalk is obviously not ancient. They were just inscribed, sort of incised in the stone. And on the right side also has these signs on the side, but an Egyptian inscription on the right shoulder. And that was really helpful for Gardner, who was also an Egyptologist, young at the time, but quite a talented Egyptologist. And Gardner said, "Well, look, I know what the Egyptian says. The Egyptian says, essentially, Meriat Chathor, the beloved of Chathor. Chathor was the goddess of the mine, the patron goddess of the turquoise mine. And Meriat means beloved of." So he started looking at these, and he realized that, you know, I don't know if the zoomed in picture is clearer or less clear, but he realized that if he made an intelligent guess about how this worked, he could actually figure out a way of reading this. So the intelligent guess turns out to be a key to the entire alphabet, the entire invention of the alphabet. And the guess was that each of the signs is a picture of something, something, you know, reasonably recognizable, and that the sign itself does not stand for that object. It stands for the first sound of that object. So let's take this first one. It looks a lot like the hieroglyph for water, but it doesn't matter that it's a hieroglyph. Let's just assume it's a picture of water. Water, Gardner said, in the dialect of the people who wrote this, was apparently something like mayim. It doesn't mean water. It means the first sound of the word for water. In other words, it means And then he went one by one and sort of hypothesized what each of them was a picture of. Some of them looked like the thing that they're supposed to be a picture of. Some of them were the hieroglyphs for the thing that they were supposed to be a picture of. This next one is supposed to be an ox. If you're thinking in Hebrew, you might be thinking, sure, but I'll come back to that in a second. But in fact, Gardner said, well, the more likely word would be Aleph or Aleph. In the Torah, we have phrases like Shigar Alafecha v'ashterot sonecha, and Aleph is an ox, and that you can see the horns and the eye and the face. And he sort of went one by one. And the key thing is that it winds up actually meaning something. So this one winds up meaning Mem Aleph Hey Bet Ayin Lamed, and then sort of effaced over here is a Taf. The Ayin is pretty clear. It's an I. It's just sideways. Bet, of course, means a house. And if you read it that way, then it winds up reading in something like Hebrew, but not exactly Hebrew. Mu'ahab ba'alat, or mi'uhab ba'alat. In other words, the beloved of the mistress, the beloved of the goddess of the place, which, of course, was really enticing because, as you recall, the Egyptian inscription on the shoulder also said the beloved of Hathor, the beloved of the goddess of the mine. So Gardner put this out there. Again, the key point is not so much the decipherment of this particular inscription, although that's really cool. It's more that if this is all right, then it tells us how the alphabet was invented. So since then, about 20 years ago, some graffiti, apparently alphabetic graffiti, was found down southern Sinai at a place called Wadi al-Hol near Thebes. And that puts the alphabet even a few hundred years earlier than that. So we now know of alphabetic inscriptions from about 1800 or 1900 BCE, in other words, almost 4,000 years ago. I'm not going to spend time trying to say exactly what these inscriptions mean, although I'm happy to share the slideshow with anyone afterwards, and you can puzzle over them as well. But here's the key point about how the alphabet was actually invented. And I put this here in this in sort of enumerated way because I want to emphasize just how unobvious it was to invent this sort of writing system. So the first thing that the inventor would have had to do was actually think about how many sounds they have in their language. And that's actually a complicated question. I'll put it out there as a question. You can tell me what you think on the chat or the Q&A. How many phonemes do you think there are in English or in Hebrew? So I'll just say, don't think about how many letters there are in the alphabet. That's the wrong answer. How many phonemes is a much harder question. And I say that to emphasize that most speakers of language, I mean, the vast majority of speakers of language, have no idea how many phonemes there are in their own language. So I am curious what you think. So really do feel free to share your thoughts on that. But that has to be the first step in the invention of the alphabet. The inventor actually has to think about their own language and figure out how many phonemes there are in their language. They also have to decide to include only consonants. I think as most people know, the early alphabets did not include vowels. And this is a tricky point. It's a complicated point, and it's not an obvious point. It could be that was inspiration from Egyptian, but it's hard to know exactly why they made that decision. Then, of course, the interesting game to play is to, to assign a sign to each phoneme. Sorry about that typo. But in other words, think about some sort of picture that I can draw to represent each phoneme. So if I figured out that there's a b sound in my letter, in my language, and then that's different than the p sound in my language, which isn't true for every language, but let's assume it's true for my language, then I have to come up with a word that starts with a b and a word that starts with a p, a word that I can draw pretty easily, and assign that each of the values. And then I have to teach this to other people. Once I do that, I can theoretically write anything that I can think. So any word I can think of, I can now write. And that makes it, of course, useful. Now, you know, it struck me, I think this was last year, in our kids' preschool class, that this actually goes on all the time. So a sign like this, which sort of aims to teach the alphabet, I'm not exactly sure what the aim is, but let's assume it's aiming to teach the alphabet, has actually done all that work. It actually came up with a picture that starts with each of, not the phonemes, so this is not a, you know, a linguist would object, but starts with each of the letters of the English alphabet, presumably meant to be sort of easily recognizable and easily identifiable, so that in theory, what you can do here is actually take these pictures and write anything with them. In other words, instead of writing S, I can now use a picture of a saw. Instead of writing T, I can now use a picture of a turtle. Instead of writing D, I can use a picture of a dog. And if I just teach that to you, then that is actually a functional alphabet. So I played with that here. I guess I'll give you like 5 seconds to see if you can figure out what this says. Let me know by the chat if you figure it out. Yeah, impressive, right. It means, it says the invention of the alphabet, which was sort of the only thing I could think of this morning when I was doing that. Very impressive. I guess that was, Dr. Putterman. Yeah, very impressive. Good job. Okay, so that's, the point is that you can actually do this once you come up with icons for each of the letters. You can write anything. I can now write anything with these new pictures. I would just have to teach it to everyone else. And it's now a functional alphabet. Okay, now, so here are some of the obvious ones. Mayim, the first word for water, aleph for ox, ayin for an eye. And of course, you can see that this is not exactly Hebrew, but it's also a close cousin of Hebrew. That's obviously true. So Sinai 349 is one of them that seems fairly readable. And I'm going to just, you know, look at one line with you. So this is if you look at the second line, there's a head, and then a house, and then a snake, and then apparently a sort of a deformed monkey, another house, another snake, water, and that would be resh, bet, nun, kuf, bet, nun, mem, so something like rav, nakvanim, in other words, the chief of the miners. You could quibble about some of the details, but that's more or less what we have, and of course, again, this is a turquoise mine, so finding a text that talks about the rav, nakvanim, seems like a pretty good finding. There are some quirks of this early alphabet. So this is Latin. You notice something about early Latin. You could probably read some of this to yourself, but the key is that there's something missing that we take for granted. And that, of course, is spacing, spaces between words. Early alphabet did not have spaces or any other sort of indication to indicate when a word began or ended. Which certainly makes it harder to read. So I assume you're all reading this as I talk. It is true that it's much easier to do this if you're reading out loud. And so it's possible that early alphabetic inscriptions were meant to be read out loud, but it's hard to know. If you add the fact that there's also no vowels, it becomes really hard. So no spacing, no vowels. This is actually really, really difficult to do. And of course, no punctuation. Which I cheated by adding an exclamation point here, but yeah, this is supposed to say it's a lot harder with no vowels or spaces or punctuation, and that really is pretty hard. But in any event, the alphabet sort of slowly takes root, and the map I gave you here is really just an example. I put the center here at Sir Abd al-Khadim, but I don't really mean to say that the alphabet was invented at Sir Abd al-Khadim. We actually don't know where it was invented. There's all sorts of hypotheses that I won't worry about right now. The key is that over the next few hundred years, the alphabet does spread across the Near East. So we find it in Ugarit up in Syria. We find it in Israel. I'll come back to that soon. We find it in Mesopotamia. We find it down in Yemen by about the year 1000 BCE, so about 3,000 years ago, the alphabet had reached Yemen, and we find it down in southern Egypt, as we talked about. In the interest of time, I'm not going to talk much about it, but Ugarit, the Syrian city right near the Mediterranean coast, is one of the more interesting places where we find alphabetic writing fairly early, by the 14th century BCE. They sort of modify the alphabet so that it's written on clay instead of in ink or on stone. The most important thing I'll say about it right now is that they show us that there's already an alphabetic order. You know, it already goes in the Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey order. It gets a little tricky in some of the details, but I'll put the details aside for now. We find it in Israel by the 13th century, so in the 1200s. This is probably before the Israelites are in the land of Israel. We find Canaanites writing. So this is in the city of Lachish. There's a ewer, a jug, a vase, which has, you can probably make it out here. You see an aleph and a lamed and a taf on top of these pictures and some more letters around, which we can actually read. It's apparently given as a present. It says Matan Shai La'alat, so it's a present given to the god, to Alat. And a bowl from the same city, same century, the Lachish bowl, also with a short inscription on it. So by the end of the second millennium BCE, we actually find alphabetic writing pretty much all over the region, but it's not the common writing. So in Mesopotamia, even though we find a little bit of alphabetic writing, they're still writing in cuneiform. In Egypt, even though we find a little bit of alphabetic writing, they're still writing in hieroglyphs or hieratic. It's really only in the in-between region, where there hadn't been a big kingdom, that the alphabet really is adopted and takes off. So that turns out to be Israel and Aram, the Arameans, Edom, Moab, Ammon, the Phoenicians, who play a very large role in the later history of the alphabet. And this alphabet then spreads throughout the world. So this is a chart taken from a classic book that's already pretty old by Yosef Nave, The Early History of the Alphabet. That's essentially a family tree of alphabets. And of course, you know, a full family tree would have to be a lot more complicated than this. And this one ends at about 1000 CE. But we get the idea that the key idea that the alphabet was invented once and then spread throughout the world. Before I just look at the last couple of slides, I just want to emphasize, so summarize the key points here. So the alphabet was invented once, almost 4,000 years ago, somewhere in the vicinity of Egypt or Israel. It's hard to say where the place of invention was. The language of the inventors was, we can't call it Hebrew, but it's certainly a cousin of Hebrew. In other words, we can tell from the pictures and the words that underlie those pictures that it's a language that has words like mame for water and bait for house, ayin for eye and elef for ox, and so on. You can think about the other letter names and you realize that lots of them actually have cognates of cousins in Hebrew. And the secret to inventing the alphabet was what we call the acrophonic principle. So acrophony, meaning that each word starts with a sound, and that the alphabet was invented on the principle that each picture stood for the first sound of that word. So that's sort of the crux of the invention of the alphabet. So not every letter can we trace in a tremendous amount of detail, but most of them we can. So I gave you a few examples here. So Egyptian hieroglyphs, which are, of course, in the background, they're not alphabetic, but they're in the background there. So you see the pictures of them. Proto-Canaanite, Aleph, let's say. This is an old Hebrew Aleph, which is actually probably, you know, if you're looking at this chart, probably better to skip over the later Hebrew and just, you know, you turn it on your side and you realize that it's the Greek A, English A. The Greeks, who I just didn't have time to talk much about today, but the Greeks borrowed the alphabet from the Phoenicians. The most important thing that they did, well, I guess there's two very important things that they did. The first important thing they did was add vowels. And that has its own story that we just we can't get into in a lot of detail, but they took essentially letters that they didn't need, like aleph and ayin and hey, and turned them into vowel letters. And the second thing is that they brought it to Europe. So from the Greeks, it goes to the Etruscans, from the Etruscans, it goes to Romans, and from the Romans, essentially goes to all of Europe. And you can follow you know, a bunch of these letters through in all sorts of interesting ways. In Israel itself, so the this is an ostracon from Izbat Tzartza, which you can see near Rosh Hashanah. And it's from about the 11th century, found by Israel Finkelstein back in the 70s. And the last line here, this text has never been fully deciphered, but the last line here, reading left to right, well, it's transcribed on the bottom here, so you can read along, but it says, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, He, Vav, Chet, Zayin, Tet, Yud, Kaf, Lamed, presumably Mem is missing there, and then Nun, Samach, Pei, Ayin, Tzadi, Kuf, Kuf, Shin, Taf. So there's a bunch of things that are wrong here, some of which might not have been mistakes, but just idiosyncrasies. But clearly the last line here is someone practicing their alphabet, someone actually writing out the alphabet. The order here is left to right. Might suggest that it hadn't yet been set what order you write in. But this is from the land of Israel. I'll skip over that now. The most exciting, relatively recent discovery, now not so recent, but in the last decade or so, was from Achir B'Kayafa, and this five-line inscription, which is still really debated what it says. So I'm hesitant to say anything about it, but this is when it was first found. So the man standing here is Professor Yossi Garfinkel of Hebrew University, who was the archaeologist who found it, showing it to Professor Frank Moore Cross of Harvard and Professor Lauren Steger, who's an archaeologist, also of Harvard. They have unfortunately both passed away since this happened, just in the last few years. But Garfinkel is alive and well and doing great work. And you see that he had brought this to Boston actually to show it to them because it was such an exciting inscription. This is just a plausible reading, really far from certain, but it might say something like Alta Ashok, Ve'eved, something. Shvot Eved Almanah, Shvot Yatom, Ger, Riv, Olel, Yachad, Yachad Melech, Ve'eved, Soch, Ger, Timoch. I'm not even going to try to put this together. You can put it together into real sentences, but there's so much uncertain here that I'm not sure it's worth it. But certainly feel free to play with it more. This is from the time of David and Shlomo, and it's from the 10th century, in Chir B'Kayafa, not far from Beit Shemesh. So certainly a really fascinating example of alphabetic writing from that time. And I think with that, we will I'll stop adding more details and just try to summarize pretty quickly. So the first 1,000 years of history, the alphabet was probably invented around 2000 BCE. We find it in Egypt, southern Sinai. It doesn't necessarily mean it was invented there, but that's where we find it. Inscriptions are really rare for the first 500, 700 years. That doesn't mean the alphabet wasn't spreading. So it was traveling all over, but it didn't take the place of all of the major writing systems like hieroglyphs and cuneiform. Those were still the primary writing systems used in the region. And in the Iron I period, what archaeologists call the Iron I period, in other words, what in Jewish history is called Tkufat HaShoftim, or the period of the judges, essentially 1200 to 1000, we get the development of a cursive script. People are clearly learning how to read and write it. And we get more inscriptions in the area of Israel. And with that, we will end. And in alphabetic writing, I will wish you all Chag Kasher V'Sameach. All right. So I'm going to look at the chat and the Q&A and see what we have here. So let me just open these two. Okay. So first of all, so Gabriel Faber asks, is there significance that this is read right to left and we read before we read left to right? So I'm not sure what this was because I don't know exactly when that was said, but the direction is really a great question. In pretty much every early script, this is true not just for alphabetic script, but for cuneiform, for hieroglyphs, there's a lot of variability in direction. Once you think about it, you realize direction is entirely random. It doesn't actually matter if I write right to left to right, top to bottom. As long as we agree on it, you'll know how to read it. So hieroglyphs, for example, forever, you can always write in whichever direction you want. The only way to know which direction hieroglyphs go in, and I guess I'll say this to you, assuming that we ever get to go back to museums, you can stop in front of a hieroglyphic inscription. Just look for any birds in the inscription. The birds face the beginning of the line. So I know they face backwards in the line. And that's the clue as to which direction hieroglyphs go in. Cuneiform, alphabets, and this happened again once the Greeks borrowed the alphabet. People write right to left, they write left to right. They write even things like right to left to left, right to left, left to right. In other words, that actually has a fancy word. The word is boustrophedon. It's as the ox plows. So you imagine like an ox going through a field. And that's totally variable. At some point, every culture just has to decide. It has to say, okay, you know what, from now on, there's a rule. We're going to write right to left or left to right or whatever it may be. There is some thinking that sometimes it might matter, it might depend on the medium. So if you're using ink, for example, it's actually really annoying to write right to left. I'm sure you've all noticed this if you're writing Hebrew. Your hand, assuming that you're righty, your hand smudges the ink as you move on in the line. So that's pretty annoying. So that's one advantage to writing left to right. But of course, it is in the end, just a cultural practice that has to be decided on. All right. David Tesler asked, what are the earliest evidences we have of royal archives being written? So that's a great question. We have already from the third millennium BCE, the late millennium BCE in Mesopotamia. We have royal archives. I guess the question is, you know, depends on what you would require to call something an archive. But people start collecting documents. You know, essentially, once you have a functioning state that has writing, they realize that records are really important. Now that's, maybe I should have emphasized one thing when we were talking about the invention of writing. Sometimes people say that writing, let me put it this way. Writing was almost certainly invented for bureaucratic purposes, not for state purposes. Now, there's that whole shepherd story that I told you at the beginning. We don't need a state for that to happen. This doesn't necessitate a king or a state or any sort of bureaucracy. So writing is probably not dependent on there being a state. It's probably just important for economic use rather than bureaucratic state control. So that's something that the... we sort of see in different ways in different cultures, but they so archives start already by the third millennium BCE. All right, what was this other? I just lost the Q&A. How do I get back to Q&A? Ah, here we go. I skipped from pictographs to alphabet. That is certainly true. I didn't talk about syllabic writing, so I had 35 minutes to talk about the invention of art, writing, and the alphabet. So we did a lot, but yeah, it's certainly true that, there's a lot more that we skipped over in the development of it. Some of which is actually just hypothetical and we don't really know that much about, but certainly worth thinking more about. The question that someone else asked, Baruch Alster asked, how innovative was the alphabet? So it's an interesting question. You know, we tend to think of innovation today, certainly we think of innovation as inherently good. The alphabet was, I think, conceptually a major innovation. I don't want to, rank it on the list of major innovations, but it's a conceptual leap forward in terms of thinking. I shouldn't say that. It's a conceptual leap in terms of thinking about how to transcribe language in writing. Whether it's a good idea or not is a much harder question. And the truth is, until you add word dividers and vowels, it's a really difficult one. So it's very simple to learn. You know, if you think about Hebrew, for example, there's only 22 signs. But if you have 22 signs without any indication of where a word begins and ends, without any indication of the vowels, you're really relying a tremendous amount on the reader's ability to decode that. And that's not true for hieroglyphs and cuneiform. Hieroglyphs and cuneiform are much simpler to read once the writing system is mastered. So it takes a much longer time to master the writing system, but once you know it, the reading's pretty easy. That's not true for alphabetic writing until you get vowels and spaces. So it's a tricky question. It's clearly innovative, but I think it actually is not perfected for a little while. And one more question, and I think we'll have to end with this one. The question is, does the simple writing system, does that mean it was made for the masses? In other words, is this accessible in a way that cuneiform and hieroglyphs were not? So that's actually a fantastic question. And I'll say the following. it took a massive amount of investment on the part of a family and a person to become a cuneiform or hieroglyphic scribe. Years and years of schooling, which meant that only wealthy families could do it, and literacy was way under 1% of the population. In theory, alphabetic writing is much more accessible. It doesn't mean it actually was more popular. We don't actually know that that literacy rates suddenly skyrocketed, but it certainly opened the door for literacy rates to skyrocket. There is some, I've had some arguments about this with some of my colleagues in the last few years, but I think that's sort of pretty clearly true. Right. So it opens the door. It doesn't actually mean it happened. It still took some time, and it took schools to actually learn how to be an alphabetic scribe. We have some evidence, but really not a lot of evidence for scribal training, let's say in ancient Israel. And it's in a very practical way. People still have to learn how to read and write. They have to learn the alphabet and things like that. That ostracon from Isbet Sarta, where someone's just practicing writing, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. We have a bunch of texts from around Israel, which are called absideries, and there's just Aleph, Bet written out. That's almost certainly that schooling, that people are just learning it. Now, it's obvious that it takes a lot less time to learn 22 signs of the Hebrew alphabet than it takes to learn the 500, 600 signs of cuneiform or of the hieroglyphic script. It doesn't mean that a lot of more people did it, but it certainly meant that if there was the will to do it, it could have been done. So I guess I have to leave it at that. We have some evidence, but not a ton. And I think in the time remaining, it wouldn't be prudent for me to open that one. All right. So I think I'm going to have to wrap up now.
Thank you, Dr. Fuller. Is it okay if we maybe share your email address with everybody
following
the session, so that if they have questions, they can send them over to you?
Absolutely. I'm going to put it in the chat right now. And then, of course, please share it with anyone who is on the chat, on the call.
Thank you so much. Everybody stay healthy, stay safe. Dr. Kohler, thank you so much for doing this for us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It was great.
We hope to see everybody back here. Thank you. We hope to see everybody back here for additional webinars throughout the week. Thank you.
Bye-bye.